Welcome to Remedy and Rhyme, a space where poetry meets the wise power of plants. I'm your host, Kimberly Kling of Joyful Roots. We'll begin each episode with a poem, a soul offering inspired by a single herb. From there, we'll follow the thread of the plant's deeper wisdom, exploring what it reveals to the heart, how it invites us into greater awareness, and how we might welcome that into our own lives. Then we'll ground that insight with simple ways to work with the herb in your everyday life rhythms. So whether you're here for the poetry, the plant stories, or the space in between, I'm so grateful that you've joined me. This podcast is for educational and inspirational purposes only. I am not a medical doctor or a licensed health professional, and nothing shared here is intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any disease. The information provided has not been evaluated by the FDA. Herbs are powerful allies, but not without personality. If you experience an allergic reaction or discomfort from any herb mentioned, please stop taking it immediately. Also, if you're on any medications, please check with your doctor about any possible herb-drug interaction. Most importantly, you and you alone are the steward of your own body. What you choose to consume, apply, or integrate is entirely up to you. This podcast is about health empowerment. Listen with curiosity and always honor your body's wisdom. Hi, thank you for being here again with me. I'm really thrilled to be back. This episode is going to be all about my friend, the mesquite tree. And before we start this episode, I'd like to take a moment to just say that I would like to honor the original and ongoing stewards of this land in this podcast episode. The San Pedro River Valley is the traditional homeland of the Otum people, the Apache people, the Yuwimi people, who are also known as the Yaqui, and other indigenous people who have lived in deep relationship with the mesquite tree for countless generations, as well as the land that I currently live on. I'm going to do my best to speak with respect and to honor the names, the stories, and the pronunciations of the people and cultures whose wisdom runs through this place. However, I'm not a native speaker to any of these languages, so please offer me a little bit of grace if I pronounce things wrong. I am also not speaking for any indigenous communities in this episode, but I'm trying to create a podcast out of deep respect and gratitude for the teachings that they have shared with the world through the land, through conversations, and through what continues to endure despite colonization. So this episode is offered in a spirit of reverence, and it's just a small offering as a part of reconnecting with the land and recognizing the indigenous presence that is not only historical but alive and ongoing today. Let's begin with a poem. This is a poem that I wrote entitled Songs for the Land. Open your mouths. Let sweet songs shower the land. She welcomes it, craves it, deserves it for all she does and holds. She wants to feel the hum, untampered resonance of your heart reverberating with hers, as the honeybees do, buzzing with life, lilting ballads of gratitude and belonging, vibrations tactile with pleasure, alchemizing nectar into food of the gods. Oh, sweet elixir of gold, teach me as you flow over undulating terrain. My collarbone, my hips shaping rivers of abundance which spill into the delta of my own body, filling my vessel with a flourishing ocean of harmonies. Drip from my apple blossom lips, note after note after note, a symphony for Gaia. As we begin this episode, I'd like to anchor us in place for a moment. I'm speaking to you from the heart of the San Pedro River Valley, where the last undammed desert river in the southwest winds through mesquite bosques and ancient floodplains. I'm speaking to you from the mesquite forest that is the land I live on, as the honeybees set the air abuzz with the hum of song. This is a land steeped with stories, I'm nestled near Tombstone and Bisbee, and long before these settlements, the home of the mammoth hunters, the Clovis people. In this place, there's a tree species that has been around longer than asphalt, longer than fences, longer than the nation state itself. Fossil evidence suggests that mesquite trees have existed in North America since the Pleistocene epoch, at least 7,000 to 8,000 years, but probably much longer. First Nations peoples of this land have worked with the mesquite for thousands and thousands of years. Archaeological records from the Hohokam and Otham settlements include mesquite pods, seeds, and wood in food preparation and construction contexts. This land remembers the songs. The cottonwoods whisper it in the spring wind, and the curved-billed thrashers sing it from the twisted mesquite limbs. And the mesquite embodies these songs. This is a region that's often defined by scarcity, scarcity of rain and scarcity of temperate days. But the mesquite tree teaches us another truth in this land that we may have many misperceptions about. The mesquite is teaching us that life can be generous without being loud, and that abundance is not the same as accumulation. The mesquite's roots run deep, sometimes more than 100 feet into the earth, tapping into hidden waters we'll never see. And from these depths, it draws up not only moisture, but memory. The memory of nourishment, of interdependence, of what it means to give without depleting. Its pods arrive in these golden cascades, enough to feed deer, javelina, coyotes, cattle, insects, birds, and humans. And still, they fall in generous heaps to the ground. That is true abundance. That is radical abundance. This kind of abundance isn't the kind that's sold in shiny packaging. It's not the stuff of excess that our modern culture likes to sell us constantly and dangle over our heads. This is the kind of abundance that feeds everyone without taking more than the land can give. That is true abundance. It's regenerative and continues giving through the whole life cycle. There's a common story out there, one that I've heard in spoken conversations as well as read in various places, that mesquites are weeds, they're invaders, they're a nuisance to be cut down or bulldozed. And I've even read some people saying that mesquite are invasive species, but that story is missing the deeper truth. Mesquites aren't strangers here. They've been part of this land for thousands of years. They are both native and vital to this land. Their roots run deep into the earth, and their history is woven throughout various cultures, wildlife, and the very soil of this desert. According to the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum, mesquite, which are the Neltuma or Prosopis genus in Latin, were once co-evolved with ancient giants like mastodons and ground sloths who feasted on the sweet pods and dispersed the seeds far and wide in their dung. The journey that the seeds took through the guts of these animals actually increased seed viability by killing off various parasites like the Bruchid beetle parasite, which led to better germination rates of these seeds. And when those great animals vanished about 10,000 years ago or so, the mesquite's range shrunk, and they started to cling more to the floodplains where water could still move the seeds and scarify them over the bounding water and the rocks. And with the arrival of cattle a few hundred years ago, the mesquite started to be able to expand their range once again, because the cattle would eat the mesquite pods, and similar to these giant creatures of the Pleistocene epoch, they would release these seeds in their feces, and the mesquite had a new way of recolonizing hillsides and uplands. To many ranchers, this reappearance was unwelcome. Mesquites have become labeled as a nuisance, invasive, and a problem, but that label is sort of overlooking a deeper truth. That mesquite is actually native to this region and an elder of this land, and this return of the mesquite tree is not an invasion, but an act of resilience. Mesquite trees can typically live between 100 to 200 years, but under some ideal circumstances, they've been known to live over 300 years. And even when the above ground parts die back because of drought or grazing or being cut down, mesquite trees can re-sprout from the roots, and this makes their presence on the land incredibly resilient and persistent. Their deep tap roots allow them to survive extreme droughts and also anchor them in place for generations, sometimes even outlasting the ecosystems that once surrounded them. This is where I like to look to mesquite for some answers about how we can incorporate the wisdom of the mesquite into our own lives. Mesquite is a tree that thrives where others perish. It's a tree that offers shade in the unforgiving sun, and a tree whose seeds nourish, whose limbs offer firewood, and whose presence literally heals the soil. Mesquite's pods are very nourishing. They're protein-rich, low glycemic, and filled with soluble fiber. And so when these pods are dried and ground, they become a naturally sweet flour, which was once a staple food for the Thonaotham people, the Akmilotham people, and many others who walked and tended these lands long before us. Even today, mesquite flour is revered for its ability to stabilize blood sugar and feed the microbiome. This is food with memory, and it's food that's native to this land, the deserts of Turtle Island, which we now call North America. It is food that is still offered by the mesquite to this day and still nourishes many people of this place. The wood of the mesquite tree is dense and slow burning. It's also beautifully fragrant. It's actually pretty legendary for its heat and its flavor, and it's used for both warmth and for cooking. It burns hot with a clean flame, and its smoke carries a distinctive scent that's earthy, grounding, and pretty unmistakable. In the desert, where winters still have a bite to them and resources can be rather sparse, mesquite is more than just comfort, it's also about survival. Mesquite is a legume, which means it's a nitrogen fixer. And through its roots and its symbiotic relationship with the microbes of the soil, it can capture nitrogen from the air and return it to the earth, which ultimately improves the fertility of the soil and everything around it. In places that have been degraded by overgrazing or erosion, mesquite is often one of the first plants to move in, not as an invader, but as a restorer of that ecosystem. And it stabilizes dust-prone soil, shades out some of the invasive grasses, and can create microclimates where new life can take hold. Mesquite literally is holding it all together. Mesquite is not only incredibly generous to humans, but it's also incredibly generous to wildlife. There's been ecological disaster all over the news lately. We know our pollinators are in crisis. Native bees are disappearing. Their habitats are shrinking, their food sources are being poisoned or paved over, and monarchs and other keystone species are also dwindling. It can sort of make us feel helpless, like the problems are too big or too far away or too tangled up in politics or industry to touch. But here in the desert, there's this tree that is quietly doing some of the work of restoration. Mesquite is feeding the bees, cooling the land, and nourishing entire communities, both human and more than human alike. Mesquite is so much more than a tree. It's literally a living, breathing food pantry. Birds and mammals and insects and fungi and microbes all find a bustling network of mutual support rooted in the mesquite's shade. Speaking of shade, there's something that I really would love people to understand before they choose to cut down a mesquite tree, because mesquites don't just offer shade for comfort, they actively cool and stabilize their surroundings, and they play a huge role in desert temperature regulation as well as ecosystem support. The temperatures under a mature mesquite tree can be so significantly cooler than the ambient air temperature, often 15 to 30 degrees lower than the surrounding air. This natural shading helps to slow soil evaporation and protect ground level plants and create a more stable microclimate for insects, birds, and animals, not to mention a more pleasant environment for us humans. In hot desert environments where the heat of the midday sun can be absolutely scorching in the summer, That kind of relief can be life-saving to both animals and humans alike. The thickets of the mesquites and the low limbs provide shelter and nestling space. The curved-billed thrashers and cactus wrens make their homes in the nooks and crannies of the branches, and hawks and owls perch in the higher limbs, watching the ground for movement. And the tree becomes really a refuge that's cooler by so many degrees than the open soil in the summer. It's also helping to hold in moisture and anchoring fungal and microbial life in its roots and in the rich mulch that it drops year after year. Right now, the mesquites that are in my yard are in full bloom. These flowers are fragrant and protein-rich, and they bloom with such abundance in the spring and early summer that they're literally humming with bees, both wild bees and honeybees. Native pollinators like leafcutter and mason bees rely on the mesquite blossoms for nectar and pollen, and the tree's bloom cycle often bridges this gap between other spring and summer flowers when there wouldn't necessarily normally be an abundance of other types of food. The pods, which are sweet elongated fruits of the mesquite, feed so many different animals: quail, coyotes, javelina, rabbits, deer, countless rodents, and, like we've mentioned many times, humans. Even when they fall onto the ground, they offer nourishment both to animals and to the tree and other plants around them. Pack rats and kangaroo rats collect these fallen pods, and tortoises nibble on them. They break down and nourish the soil. The tree is literally feeding the desert seed by seed. The Thana Othum Nation, the Chiricahua Apache, and the Opata people have inhabited the San Pedro River Valley for over 12,000 years and possibly quite a bit longer. These communities have traditionally utilized mesquite for food, medicine, and materials. And today, many of the First Nations individuals and groups continue to engage in mesquite harvesting and processing and maintaining these cultural practices, which really contribute to ecological stewardship. Even in drought, when nearly everything else pulls back, the deep taproots of the mesquite still keep reaching down into hidden underground waters and then offering those leaves, their pods, and their presence to the beings that are trying to survive the drought. Even in death, the mesquite keeps offering. Talk about radical abundance. The fallen limbs of the tree become homes for beetles and burrows for reptiles. And as the dying mesquite tree decomposes, it becomes fertile soil. So when we sit under a beautiful mesquite tree, we might be in the presence of a being who has stood through colonization, industrialization, and climate shift, and is still offering us radical abundance, abundance of shade, food, fuel, and so much more. Can we think about how this could relate to our own lives and this world? In a world that tells us that we're not enough unless we consume, unless we hustle, unless we keep on buying things, mesquite is rooting us in enoughness, in place, in reciprocity, and in something much older than capitalism and so much more lasting than the plastic trinkets and things that we might be buying from the store. So again, I'll repeat the message of the mesquite. Mesquite is offering us a message of radical abundance, abundance that's not extractive. It's relational, it regenerates, and it renews. I'm sharing the following story with gratitude and respect for the Othum people who continue to live in relationship with the mesquite tree. The story I'm about to share comes from a rich tradition of Othum oral storytelling, which was passed down for generations across the Sonoran Desert. This was originally told by Ventura Jose, known as Winch, and I don't know if I'm saying that right, but he was an esteemed narrator from the village that is now called Sonora, Mexico. And after his passing, his stories were carefully transcribed and preserved through the collaborative efforts of Otham speakers, linguists, and folklorists, including Juan Dolores and Dean and Lucille Saxton, among others. These stories were published to honor and preserve the wisdom and voices of the storytellers for future generations. So I'm sharing the story not as an expert or an owner, but just as a grateful guest, and I'd like to honor the lineage that it comes from, hold space for the beauty, humor, and teachings that it carries. This is called Coyote Scatters Mesquite Beans. Somewhere there lived a man named Siwani. Siwani was very important and had a big house with many rooms. When anyone came to his house, he would say, "Don't try to go in this room. I have many rooms where you can sleep, but this is for myself alone." Siwani was very important, and everybody believed him, so no one knew what he had shut up in that room. He didn't let anyone see what was in there. The people said, "Let's find out right now what's in there that Siwani doesn't want to let us see. Maybe he has a daughter shut up in there and doesn't let us see her." Then they decided someone should go and smoke with him. And the next night, others should go and smoke with him. Sometime he'll get sleepy and go to sleep. Then we'll call Coyote and he'll see what's in there that Siwani doesn't want to let us see. So they did what they said. Many people gathered at the house of Siwani. Coyote didn't go to the house, but hid out a ways. All night, they didn't let Siwani sleep. The next night, some others came and smoked all night with Siwani until morning. The next night, others also smoked with Siwani. Siwani sat outside the house. In the doorway of the room, he would not let them see into. But now the people knew that the next night, Siwani would have to go to sleep. It was the fourth night. Some people again came and smoked with him all night, and in the middle of the night, Siwani went to sleep. Coyote was still hidden out away in the open. They told him that Siwani had gone to sleep, so Coyote came creeping behind the people and went in. At that time, there were no mesquite trees here, and Coyote did not know what it was he saw standing there in that room. He thought, "Look, there is no girl to be seen anywhere. It must be this he treasures and would not let us see. What can it be? Maybe it's something good to eat. I'll taste and see what it tastes like." That's what Coyote thought. At the time, this mesquite had a lot of beans which were ripe and scattered below. Coyote tasted the beans and they were sweet, so he crept around chewing them until he was full. Just then, Siwani woke up and heard someone noisily chewing. He suddenly became alert. The people shouted, saying, "Hey, what are you going to do, Siwani?" And they frightened Coyote with their shouting. Siwani was just going into the room that he kept guarded when Coyote dashed out between his legs and out the door and ran off. The smokers rushed out after Coyote in Siwani's way. Coyote had already gone a long way when Siwani dashed out and chased him. Coyote ran along, scattering mesquite beans where there are now many mesquite. Siwani chased Coyote for 4 days and finally stopped chasing him somewhere at the foot of Girded Rock. So Coyote escaped and went about telling them, "This is good food, and I have scattered its seed. Maybe when it comes up, you will gather it and eat it. It's really sweet." So the mesquite came up and produced beans. Now people gather it and eat it. And just as Coyote shared this gift of sweet nourishment, mesquite is continuing to offer its gifts today, not only as food, but as a source of nourishment for our bodies in deeper ways. From its pods to its bark, mesquite carries a long legacy of physical support across many desert communities. Just as Coyote told us, mesquite pods are naturally sweet, but their sweetness comes from complex carbohydrates and soluble fiber that are slow to absorb, much slower than most other sugars. They're also high in calcium, magnesium, iron, and zinc. And the pods were traditionally ground into flour by many indigenous communities and were used as a sustaining food source that actually can help to regulate blood sugar and energy levels over time. Today, mesquite flour is often recognized for its low glycemic impact. And although mesquite flour is not a complete protein, It does contain a surprising amount of amino acids, which can help stabilize appetite and support tissue repair, among other things. Mesquite is also quite supportive of the digestive system. Mesquite gum, which is a sap that's exuded from the bark of the mesquite, was traditionally chewed like a natural gum, and it's been used for sore throats, to support oral health, and to ease digestive irritation with its soothing demulcent action. This action can also offer relief for dry tissue or minor inflammation of the gut. And there's actually a market for mesquite sap in Australia, and oddly enough, Texas exports quite a bit of mesquite sap to Australia. Mesquite flour, being high in soluble fiber, helps to feed beneficial gut bacteria, promote regularity, and soothe digestion, especially when there's a dry or a sluggish system. It can be extra supportive in those situations, and it's also slightly alkalizing and has a good amount of antioxidants, which give it some more beneficial properties. The inner bark and leaves of the mesquite have been used for topical washes or poultices for wounds, infections, or inflammation. And these traditional uses are also supported by modern findings that mesquite contains antimicrobial and astringent compounds, particularly tannins, which might help to fight pathogens and promote tissue repair. The sap can be applied to scrapes and other types of skin lesions to act as a protective barrier, and that sap has also been used to make baskets waterproof, so you can see how it would potentially be beneficial to our skin, especially in times where we don't have band-aids. The leaves can also be chewed and used as a poultice to put on the skin for things like stings. From an energetic standpoint, mesquite is considered to be cooling and moistening, so this is really a welcome balance in this arid desert climate. And whether it's used as a tea, as flour, or maybe chewable gum, mesquite's gifts soften dryness and ease inflammation in both our own bodies and within the environment that we live in. This is another super sweet gift to add to our plethora of abundant gifts that the mesquite offers. So, as we wrap up today's episode, I would like to leave you with these final thoughts, which you can think about or journal and be inspired by Mesquite's story of abundance and its nourishing gifts. What parts of myself have I kept guarded behind a door, like Suwannee? And what wisdom or sweetness might be waiting there if I opened it? How do I relate to sweetness in food, in life, in relationships? Do I allow it in? And on what terms? What does abundance feel like in my body? And how do I know when I'm rooted in abundance versus chasing it? And lastly, what beliefs or stories about scarcity have shaped the way that I give, receive, or ask for support? And how can I open myself to a greater kind of abundance that is cyclical, slow growing, and community sustaining. If you would like to submit a poem to be considered for one of the future podcast episodes, please email that to kim@joyfulroots.com. And in the subject of the email, you can put that it is a poetry submission for Remedy and Rhyme. That would be helpful and wonderful, and I can't wait to hear from you. If you appreciate what I'm doing here with this podcast and would like to help support all future endeavors, you can do that a few ways. First and foremost, if you're able to rate and review the podcast in whatever platform you are listening to this, those positive ratings and reviews help us get in front of more people. You can also join our Remedy and Rhyme Patreon page, which is available at patreon.com/joyfulroots. You'll find all sorts of goodies there, including plant stories, recipes, and more. There is a free membership, but if you are able to help support the podcast via any sort of monetary donation, that is super appreciated. This episode is also brought to you in part by my favorite matcha on the planet, Posana Matcha. It's certified organic, third-party tested to ensure that it's free of heavy metals. It's pure, safe, and absolutely delicious. I love indulging in this every day. It's a single-origin matcha that's grown in the lush fields of Shizuoka, Japan. And honestly, it's the only matcha that I reach for anymore. So when you use my code JOYFULROOTS, that's JOYFULROOTS, at checkout on Posana's website, you'll get 10% off your order, and you'll be supporting this podcast through the small affiliate commission that I receive, which helps me to continue creating this empowering herbal content just for you. You can find the link in the show notes or head to posana.net, that's P-O-S-A-N-A.net, and use the coupon code JOYFULROOTS at checkout for 10% off your order. I'd like to give thanks for the music in the intro and the outro that is called Bedtime After a Coffee by Ikun Baradine on Chosik. I'd like to give immense thanks to my family for supporting me in this herbal journey and for all of my friends and community who have also been so supportive. I'd like to give a shout out to all of the other herbalists who have influenced me. There are really just too many to name, but I'm so appreciative. And of course, my deepest gratitude goes to our plant allies who have honestly taught me more than I could have ever imagined. I'll see you in the next episode.